I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom. So you wanna be a rider, well you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the rent room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Rant Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, Tracy?
2017. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
That would be this year. Okay.
So y'all know how we do it on the Rant Room. On the show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. So you hear his voice.
No doubt.
The infamous. The pimp dog himself.
Oh, no.
How many hyphens you want today, Tracy?
Oh, come on, man. Come on, man.
TV writer himself, one-hour drama writer, producer, Tracy Grant in the house. What's up, my man?
You bring the smoke, I bring the lighter. What it do?
Oh, shit. The house is burning down.
Nice to be with you. And y'all know, like, anyone listens to the Rant Room, y'all know Hilliard has a cadre of co-hosts who he calls on, so I don't take it lightly.
Exactly.
When I get the call, shout out to Lisa.
Yeah.
I hear you out there freaking it on other people's podcasts, mm-hmm. podcast star now. Mm-hmm. And I got my homie from way back in the house.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce
him. Yeah, what's up? I'm Kenji Jasper, writer, author, journalist, staff writer on Showtime's The Chi, doing a little bit of everything. And I know Lisa. I wanted to meet her. She's a longtime Facebook friend, but I guess next time.
That's what's up. So we'll get into you a little bit today since we have you on the show. We're waiting for Chris Derrick to come in from the Derrick Brothers writing directing team.
The unauthorized CBD.
Yes, of course. You got him down.
That's my dude.
Shadow Boxer Cinema.
I'm loving
motherfucker.
Unauthorized.
Exactly. So we got you on the show. So before we started, but let's just go ahead and get in on this Nicki Minaj, Remy Ma issue, because that shit was funny. Well, so tell the kids who don't know.
Set it up
for everybody. What happened?
Kenji and I are what you might classify as hip hop cats.
Hip hop heads.
That would be accurate.
For lack of a better term. Uh-huh. And it's very fashionable now, but you know.
Yeah, y'all OGs.
We've been hip hop heads for a minute. So yes. We're on our way up here. Uh-huh. Kenji's telling me about this Remy Ma diss record. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my girl watches Love and Hip Hop at home. So I'm thinking of the Remy.
He's trying to pretend like he don't watch. Look.
I do what she says. I do what she says. So,
and you're a good man. That's a smart man. That's what I would do too.
No doubt. No
She's
doubt.
Not playing.
I will touch on that in a second. But he's telling me about this wreck. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And mind you, came up as a DJ, the whole thing. I'm mm-hmm. in my scripts. We have a project we're working on together, which cool. you're aware of. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, cool. We got some time. We plugged the phone into the car system, mm-hmm. and that's one of the ruggedest diss Dude. Records that have come out from anyone easily in the last 15 years.
It's a complete destruction of Nicki Minaj's self-esteem on political, social, personal, and financial level.
She battle rapped her. She went personal.
The record is 6 minutes in like 27 seconds.
No
like,
breath, bitch. No breath.
Literally, Remy Ma, who was in prison for uh-huh. like a decade, uh-huh. went through Nicki's entire career, Damn. Aired her out, and said, hey, look,
right.
I just did this just because you, two, what was it, 48 hours after the mm-hmm. Gucci Mane record where Nicki was dissing her came out. So mm-hmm. she wasted no time. Yeah. And
do we know why Nicki went in on her at all?
I think it seems to have dealt with a lot of things out in the street or mm-hmm. running into each other or what have you. Or I also, you know, if you listen to the record, I think, you know, Remy, not unlike some other female rappers, feel like Nikki kind of lifted a lot of her, you know, a lot of her stuff going in, mm-hmm. and wanted to call her out. You want to pull a gun on her? Hey, mm-hmm. she'll pull a much bigger gun on you.
Right.
Chris Derrick from the writing directing team. The Derrick brothers just walked in. What's up, Chris?
There he is.
People, how you doing?
What's up, big Chris?
I'm late.
Is that right? Is that right? So we're talking about, we were just before you walked in, Chris, and we started the podcast. They were playing for me the new Nicki Minaj battle against
Remy Ma.
Beef against Remy Ma.
Well, but it's Remy Ma's assassination of Nicki Minaj. There's no beef.
And we had to play it for you when we got it. It was like, dude, you got to hear this.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I haven't heard this either. I've heard of the beef,
yeah.
but I haven't heard the diss.
I think it just came out yesterday.
Yeah.
She took Nas's Ether, the beat from Nas's Ether, and called the record Sheether.
Right.
It's 6 minutes and 27 seconds, and the cover is of a broken Barbie doll, broken bloody Barbie doll.
Damn.
So, like, she's going all in. You know, Nicki made a little mention of something on that Gucci Mane record. Thought she was going to get away with it. You know, oh, I'll just diss her. Nothing's going to happen. And, I mean, literally, she just got her house shot up. You know, she had a gas leak.
It's very
stove
personal.
Blew up, man.
Damn.
Somebody should call 911.
She like that. Exactly, see, someone, the reason I want to hear it because somebody had said it reminded them of like a 90s diss record.
Yeah.
Because I think the last diss record that I remember that reached his fever pitch was a thing with Drake, and that was not really even a diss.
Oh, yeah, this is not that kind of a battle. This is that was a mock battle. That was sparring like, in the gym.
Sparring, yeah, yeah.
this is more like Remy beating Nicki with a chair out in the street.
In front of everybody. Exactly. This
schoolyard shanking.
This is
stuff
making
like
Kumo D and LL Cool J look like nothing.
There are actually rumors that right now Nicki is in a hotel suite somewhere with an acupressurist, you know, a shrink, right. and probably, you know, a chiropractor right. just trying to get her back together to resume what career she has left.
So, all of your Twitters, your Snapchats, your Instagrams, your Reddit. All of that will be...
It's going to be blown up.
Blowing.
Exactly.
I mean, Facebook is a bloodbath right now. I can only imagine what Snapchat is like. Mm-hmm. But I'm over Snapchat.
Well, speaking of everybody's Twitter and all that shit, let's go ahead and everybody just tell everybody where you are on Twitter. I need to start doing a little earlier, too, so people start looking you up while you guys are in.
While they're listening. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Where you at, Chris?
I'm at unauthorized CBD.
Yes, of course.
On Twitter and on Instagram.
What about you, Tracy?
At The Real Trey, TheReelTray. I'm life coaching for goofy dudes. You can tweet me. You don't got to go through life being goofy. Uh-huh. I'll help you out.
We all nerds. Yeah, that's what's up.
And I'm at Kenji Jasper, KENJIJSPR. So, and I'm also otherplacemedia.net. So that's where you can find me.
That's what's up. And I'm your boy, Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me on Twitter. At Hilliard Guess, like that's some shit. Or you can listen to the show, Screenwriters RR. So today, if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get it in.
All right.
So as I mentioned before, Lisa Bulacaja, you know, she out there taking care of moms today. It's also Oscar Day. This is going to drop tomorrow.
No doubt.
So we don't really know what the fuck we're going to talk about today, but we got my boy Kenji on today.
All right.
Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about you. And since you're a director, we all are directors, but... and we got my man Chris on here. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about you and what you do and the new documentary you guys are doing right now.
Good looking.
Most deaf. All right.
And let's.
Oh, you direct?
Yeah, it's my directorial debut. Okay.
They have all seen the trailer.
Okay.
Brother. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Oh, all right. Yeah. See, all right.
I keep the crew tight. It's just my circle.
Well, you know, no, man. I mean, it's actually, you know, a really important story because I wouldn't be here without it. Mm-hmm. About a year ago, Tracy calls me up, and I kind of been at a weird place, wasn't doing much, trying to sort of break back into the writing game, what mm-hmm. have you. And he's like, well, I know you had this camera, because I crowdfunded a camera, and there's this guy I want you to meet. You know, mm-hmm. He's a photographer, he's 40 years of shooting, you know, African-American celebrities, politicians, all these things. Go meet him. I was like, well, all right, sure. You know, so I go over, and I meet his name is David Augie Ogburn. Mm-hmm. He's a 73. Right, 73?
74.
74 now. And he switches it up all the time.
But you know, he's 74, 79, really.
Yeah.
But I go to meet him. You know, he's a really great guy, man. You know, tons of images, really funny, really charismatic mm-hmm. guy. And so I start.
There's all kind of celebrities in.
Oh, you know, yeah, man. I mean, Nelson Mandela, Anita Baker, Tribe mm-hmm. Called Quest, mm-hmm. Little Kim.
Like shots you've seen.
No. Well, some of them you have. Mm-hmm. Some of them, you know, which a lot of them ran in smaller magazines, okay. print publications, mm-hmm. a lot of things people haven't seen in a while. So what we're doing is kind of reintroducing
That's good, then.
A really okay. great, you know, body of work. And we started with him. And then, you know, we got his friends, colleagues involved. Kathy Hughes on TV1. She's mm-hmm. part of the doc. Deanna Williams, who is a big radio personality in Philly. Mm-hmm. She's a part of it. Who else we got, Tracy?
Cora Masters Barry,
widow of the late Marion Barry, former mayor of D.C., and mm-hmm. she also was the head of the boxing commission in D.C. for a long time. A lot of it's a very D.C. centered film, but it's really a cool portrait of the man, of the struggles of being an artist, and just about kind of how a lot of people look at photographers. Or that stage of photography is kind of a dinosaur. You know, we've all got cameras now mm-hmm. and Instagram.
And everybody think they're a real photographer now.
But the thing is that
cell phone and shit.
He was a guy that had to print his own images. He was a guy that, mm-hmm. you know, was out there catching everyone when they mm-hmm. were in town, every show, every radio station interview, all mm-hmm. those kinds of things. And, you know, he captured a lot of life. So, you know, it's called Augie, and we're creeping very quickly towards post. We have one last shoot mm-hmm. and then we'll be in editing and figure out where we're going to find a home for our little project. So
we're excited.
That's yeah. what's up.
And
you're producing.
I'm producing. Mm-hmm. I am steering the ship, as they say. And for the writers who are listening, you know, sometimes you just need an additional project. There's mm-hmm. something else you need to do. I was inspired
by 7 or 8.
Exactly. Well, we can't all be Hilliard. Your 9 job having.
But I got 13 job, first of all.
You know, 13 job, man.
Get it straight. Don't be below 10 now. But talking about job.
I was inspired by Tangerine, mm-hmm. and I say this sitting here among three directors. I didn't have this burning desire to pick up a camera and shoot, mm-hmm. but I understand the need to control the process yes. and the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Augie is a friend of mine, someone we both knew. Kenji and I came up together as music journalists. Mm-hmm. He was also an author of 2 books that are in print. He has more coming. I could talk a lot about him. Very proud of him.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Oh, thank you.
And so
yeah, all right,
we both kind of claim D.C. as a second home. He grew up there.
Well, I grew up there. It's my first home.
It's his first. Close second for me.
First and second.
Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time together at BET, mm-hmm. you know,
in
when
DC.
The music scene
was
really a big deal. And so I called them, you know, got them together. I didn't have a super specific plan at that moment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've all talked a lot amongst ourselves about not waiting for anybody to open the door.
Yes.
Right.
And not expecting people to just kind of bless you or put you on for whatever reason. So mm-hmm. I said, well, here's something that we can do on our own. Not that I dreamed about producing a documentary or producing a film.
Yeah, because we're all scripted people.
But we got to, so we still are writing mm-hmm. and working on scripts and projects. And Kenji got the shy opportunity in the midst of it. So I'm happy to see a project that's worthwhile, that everybody, I think, is going to respond to. Mm-hmm. And Kenji will be making his directorial debut. True. And, you know, I'll be at the PGA knocking on the door.
2 things I want to add. One. Tracy showed me a clip for this
trailer
in December, and I thought it was really, really fascinating.
Oh, thanks, man.
I mean, like, I started photography when I was like 12.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I turned on to Gordon Parks not through Shaft, but through his photography.
Really?
And well, yeah, because when you're a kid, you can see the photography like more than you could
see the
Shaft.
Yeah, right.
Because you know parents aren't going to let you.
It was kind of rated R, right?
Watch rated R type of stuff. So I was really excited for him. You know, when it happened, I mean, that he was doing this, because mm-hmm. I think that, you know, a lot like how black writers don't get the kind of publicity that they need, we don't see enough black photographers get the publicity that they need, particularly these ones, like you said, who are older, who've done it for a long time, who know the print game, mm-hmm. everything like that. Because, I mean, ironically, at the time when you were telling me this, I had just did a show. I just did this whole process mm-hmm. of, like, doing a print, like a physical print, which I hadn't done that in, like, maybe 15 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole thing that you kind of have to, like, think about, and mm-hmm. I'm not into all this filter crap you use on Instagram, whatever like that. That tricks you into thinking that you know that you get the image the way you want, but there's so much cool stuff in there. So I was really excited to see that. Secondly, as you know, there is a WGA award for writing documentaries.
Oh, yeah.
So make sure that you get involved in that.
Thank you, sir.
Well, wow. Like I said, it's really interesting. The process in that it's a story. When you do a doc, it's a story that kind of tells itself. And when you're a scripted writer or a creative writer, you're used to kind of, you know, controlling the narrative in a certain kind of way, seeing where it goes. This was much more about, you know, just letting him just let it all hang out, just spill everything he knows time and time again. You know, I think what we probably have three takes of every sort of story.
Easily.
And, you know, but the thing is that when you write things on a page, you're seeing it in your head, you know, but when you execute it out in the world, then you see that come back. Even when you just do the trailer or just you're looking at the dailies of the things you shoot, it's like, wow, you know, I really am piecing together, you know, something that's three-dimensional. It's not just another script. It's not just that kind of thing. And it was funny while I was in the midst of that and was kind of like, well, all right, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to finish this. What's our next thing? You know, I had opportunity to write on Lena Waithe's new show on Showtime. Comet's producing it. It's called Shy. I can't talk too much about it beyond that.
Yeah, we understand.
But going...
What's up, Lena? Shout out to Lena.
Yeah, what's up, Lena?
Shout out to Lena.
You know, more or less like seeing the process and just how much a story is not completely a writer's, you know, in the television and film medium.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, the documentary is a great break from notes and the whole process and everything
control.
Else. Because at the end of the day, it's just been he and I with maybe, what, two other shooters?
Very lean crew.
Yeah, I mean, no more than six people, right? Six, seven?
Tops.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. But I'm doing the doc right now. We have like 35, 40.
that's
more power to you.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's like the budget documentary, but the cool thing is that one, it doesn't look that way.
Yeah, and two, it looks great.
And two, Trace and I have almost developed a telepathic kind of.
That's important.
I hadn't seen you in what, three years?
Yeah, been about 3 years.
Like 3 weeks ago, I saw him face to face for the first time.
What?
We've been working on this thing for like a year. Like
Kenji was on the East Coast when we started.
Yeah, okay. I left LA for a while, and this jumped off while I was there, and it's been amazing. You know?
All right, so let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Because I'm working on like a story about a historical figure, and I was trying to, you know, do much research, and in a certain extent, I'm wondering, in terms of the documentary, you don't necessarily know what the story is going to be when you go in there, but you find it as you're doing it,
right.
And that's the thing I think is interesting about. That's why I think I'm wondering if with your process and trying to find your story was analogous to what I went through and what anyone goes through when they're writing about some figure that they find interesting or some event, because they don't know the complete angle of the story they want to take it first.
What's the theme you're trying to get to? Sure.
Right. And then as you're writing, researching, which is you doing the interviews, you kind of like see it as it's coming together. Oh, this is this is how we're going to talk about this. So I'm just curious to know like the process of that. I mean, like how do you guys? You said you just want to start talking to them. I mean, like there was one interview where something clicked off. Like, oh, that's
can
way
I say
in.
Something about that? Just really
sure,
quick.
Sure, sure.
Here's the interesting thing I noticed about the trailer you guys showed us. He was being really forthcoming.
Right.
He was talking about his problems. He was talking about his addictions, like whatever it was. And I was like, damn, if you get somebody that open.
Well, it was, of all people, my father gave me some advice. He had interviewed my great-grandfather at some point in the past.
Yeah,
and he was like, well, look, you know, if you're gonna do it, make sure the camera is as out of the way as possible, that the audio stays on, and you kind of see what happens. I think for me, you know, he's a guy. And shout out to Yagi because you may check this out as well. He lives alone. You know, he's very much, I would figure, probably spends 90% of his time by himself.
Yes.
So when you ask him to tell you a story, you know, every story is kind of the golden era of his life. He had a bout with cancer, had to have his gallbladder removed. So he has a bag and he's, you know, sort of his life has been very different since then. But I think giving him an opportunity to talk about what was important to him, whether it was his own history, whether it was certain people who stood out, certain things that folks said, I wanted him to say the things that mattered to him. But sort of when you go back through, what you find sometimes is these little nuggets that have nothing to do with the direct biography story of what an artist does, but about him as a person. You know what I mean? I think like he some line he says, well, everybody now is taking pictures of their girlfriend on Instagram and half of them look like crap. You know?
Exactly.
But they're still doing it because everybody's doing it. Yeah. You know, and he has a house that's full of old school cameras, old school images. He lives in his work. And I guess my focus was finding the other bits, you know, about just who he was as a person.
Right.
And he's a complicated guy.
Yeah. Nothing too ugly, nothing too real in terms of what we wanted to get on camera. And to Chris's question, for me, I mean, I had a general idea of what the narrative could be. He's photographed a lot of celebrities. Mm-hmm. I am mindful of what a general audience might find appealing and respond to and that whole thing. But I also want Kenji to have, well, that too, but I want Kenji to have the space to be artful and creative within telling a story. But somewhere where we also make a mistake sometimes, I think, is when I think we're all perfectionists as writers. And rather than spend an infinite amount of time like on a line by line, chapter by chapter, try kind of outline, like my first thought was like, well, you know, let's do something. Let's get something done. It may not initially be perfect, but we're going to execute it and finish it so you don't have this paralysis trying to achieve perfection right off the bat. So trying to balance all of that, but we were lucky that Kenji and Augie vibe, and he was comfortable enough to really open up to us and let us take it home.
Did you guys have any big, and it seems like for the most part, except for the fact you were in D.C. at the time, and you were here, so I guess a lot of it was you almost telling him what you want, and he'd go and shoot it, and you guys, I don't know how you guys
were doing it. It wasn't kind of like, I think for the most part, man, we had no real plan going into it at first, which was helpful, because it was kind of like a Tuesdays with Maury kind of thing. I mean, I literally would go over there every other day or a couple of times a week, and we would never go over 2 hours and just get the story. Oh, and with that comes a level of trust, because I always continue to show up, you know, I always continue to have more questions, keeping him involved in what was important. You know,
so he gave you guys a lot of access. That's what's important.
Yes.
To the folks around him, and the most important thing he gave us was access to his photos. You know, he gave us an option on everything he has.
Good.
So for us, it was really, I think, kind of a digging in the crate sort of thing. Well, okay, we can't talk about every one of the thousands of images he's taken, but creating something that's a collage to showcase the breadth of his work. I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, candids, you know, different things like that.
Okay, this is what I want to ask you, because you know, as a photographer, I always, particularly when people shoot film. So do you guys like look at the contact sheets of stuff that?
A few of them. What, as he's a producer with us, you know, he's been pulling things that we want or other things that you think are interesting. Like what will kind of happen for him is that he'll let me open up his drives and just take a look at what's there. And it's insane, because you can see a young Sade, you know, you can see a young Earth, Wind & Fire who he threw a party with in his apartment, in his studio apartment, like back in 68.
Wow.
You know, Patti LaBelle, Janet Jackson, almost all the Jackson family in these different stages, Michael Jackson and a couple of, like, literally, if they came into D.C., he has them all. So for D.C., which isn't a big entertainment town, he was one of the biggest games in town. And so it's also about documenting the hustle of being a freelance artist. You know, he had to, there's no health insurance, you know, there's no security. Hey, if someone's playing at a club, you want to get paid, you got to go out and shoot that person. You may not have a flash. You know, the truth of most photographers, I can tell you, this is that you might shoot 100 images and maybe only 4 of them come out solid that you can use.
Well, see, that's the point I want to get at, because there was an exhibit at the Fahey Khan Gallery that I think closed 2 weeks ago, and it was called Contacts. And it was a lot of really, really, really famous images of big artists that we've seen, and they showed the art, the image that we know, like the, you know, there's that one Doors cover with Jim Morrison and his arms are stretched out and he looks kind of like Christ, and it's like, okay, so you see that, and that's like maybe like a, it's like a, it's a 3 by 3 foot by 3 foot image, right? But next to it was the contact sheet of the other, you know, like 10 images that they shot that session that they didn't use. And there was one that actually, there was one image in there that I thought was is a better cover. Yeah, but because it's not as somber, it's more playful. That's why I was like, and there was like the Beatles and like,
so it's about the mood that you want.
It's like the artist trying to, like, you get to see them figuring out what there's gonna be the final image, and they're all marked on, and it's like Brando and all these people going back, and it's interesting to see. In a sense, like, see their, you, that's the only way you can see their process.
Yeah, there are drawers of that stuff. A lot of it he scanned, you know, but there are drawers and folders upon folders of raw negatives, raw images that he's been through, you know, and has to kind of go back through if he wants to find certain things. But I think he has sort of a set, for lack of a better word, like platinum collection, I think, of most of the, things he'll think. And he had personal relationships with some of these people. So he was cool with Gerald Levert. You know, he was friends with Phyllis Hyman. You know, he was friends with a number of different people. And so what you have is a personal relationship with the camera with some of these folks. I mean, and I guess it's not like all really, his work isn't Leibowitz-y. You know, it's not staged, it's not framed. Sometimes someone may be looking to the left or to the right.
Yeah, know? That's...
So,
yeah,
that, you know, you might get the back of somebody's head, the streak, you know.
And to me, that's like an interesting piece of, like, history to us, because you see these iconic images, and then you realize that they had to figure out how to get the person to... the subject to relax in a certain way to give them that. And it's cool to see... all that kind of, you can tell they're massaging the, they're talking to them. They're talking in between shots, and that's what I kind of love about looking at contact sheets and stuff like that, because you kind of see how that is. It's interesting you said, made a point that, you know, DC is not the entertainment town on the West Coast. I mean, East Coast like that, and but at the same time, it's a stop off if you're doing a tour.
It's big. We knew that we would have. Because of those relationships that Kenji mentioned, we'd have great stories to go with the photos. So he's not just saying, oh, I took this person's picture. Here's Michael here, his new edition here. He's got stories for
ones. That's dope.
I mean, like he is a good example. You know, Kathy Hughes, who runs TV One, owns a lot of radio stations. One of the most powerful black women in entertainment. Augie worked with her when she was, you know, a young woman in the sales department. You know, so he's got shots of her from that era. He's got shots of her with the first groups that she worked with. Like, he has a history of maybe 15 or 20 years of her life that he just has captured by being friends with her. And I think that's kind of what we're going through. I mean, for his generation, for boomers, you know, as a lot of them are aging out, you know, moving into their twilight, I think a lot of what we're doing is a piece of work that's kind of an ode to the era before us. You know what I mean? If we're the hip-hop era, this is like the disco era, the soul era, you know, early 80s R&B, like kind of before what made us hit. And it's really great historically, but also some of the folks that we love are in there too.
Yeah.
I mean, my favorite shot is the one he caught a Dustin Hoffman on the street while they were shooting... He walked past them shooting Midnight Cowboy and got a portrait of Dustin, you know, just chilling on the set. While
authentic, hair down to his shoulders. I mean, the whole thing.
The whole Ratso Rizzo, you know, rolling and shit. Wow.
We were fortunate, but we had to recognize that, you know, this is something, again, that we could execute and, you know, we'll figure it out. That was my thought. Let's go do it. I know Kenji has the camera. You know, you're in D.C., he's there. He had called me, Augie, to ask for some information about something else, and it just got me thinking, it's like, this body of work and this career that you've had...
Yeah, nobody's documented it like this.
Documentation. Right. Yeah. And then, on another level, pure and simple, that's my man, he's getting up there, I'm big on giving my folks their flowers while they're still here. And...
Well, let me just piggyback off of that. Speaking of flowers, so I was telling you that I'm directing this documentary right now about this surf band from the 60s that opened for the Beach Boys and all these other grands.
Okay.
We started getting ready to shoot, and literally before we started shooting the first frame, one of the guys died.
Wow.
Jimmy Greenspoon from Three Dog Night, right?
Crazy.
And so, of course, it was like, well, are we going to make this movie now? Whatever. And I went, wait a minute, which is something you were piggybacking off of earlier. You know, you're trying to find what the theme is and what's it all about. And when I went, ah, this is the midpoint turn. This is the big, we're about to make this album. Everything's coming. Then
that's right.
Boom.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
Now, how are we going to make this album? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's like lots
it's
of
like
little.
A challenge and a gift in
yeah,
a way.
But it, yeah, I mean, I was trying to look at it from a positive, that what can we do with this? And I was like, well, he's probably the most famous one in the band anyway. So this is like, now this is going to be his big sequence.
That's right.
You know, that leads up to the fact that he passed right. away right. and how it affected the entire band and right. will this right. album ever come? You know what I mean?
And I mean, like you said, you never know what the story is or the story yeah. changes. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, the last couple of years, I've watched a lot of documentaries. So there was one year, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where some Oscar-nominated documentary mm-hmm. like fascinated the hell out of me. So I spent a lot of time after that, like watching documentaries.
Yeah, I'm a doctor in documentary.
And either short
fiend.
Ones or mm-hmm. these longer form ones, or that marathon OJ one.
Oh, God.
Oh yeah, no, that was a piece.
Damn, there's some man. Great ones damn. This past year
yeah,
this, for sure.
Yeah,
man,
yeah,
man, that OJ yeah, thing was man, and, especially the last installment.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we can talk about that a little later today, but. Yeah. I just feel like I think documentaries have a very strange reputation because mm-hmm. I feel maybe up until around 10 years ago, right. documentaries weren't exciting for people, you know?
Right. So,
something happened. It might have been one of those Michael Moore ones or something like that.
I'll tell you exactly yeah. what it is.
Bowling for Columbine, I would say.
It's getting through that because they're quote unquote unscripted doesn't mean that there's not a story being told.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't
it
mean
has
that
to be weaved and woven.
You know, it needs to be grounded, yes. and you know there is a narrative. Usually, mm-hmm. it may not be as literal. Mm-hmm. It may be a little more subtle, but it is there. And I think over time, people have gotten more of a command of that.
I think the other thing is that with Netflix, with Amazon mm-hmm. Prime, with you know all these online services that make content available, mm-hmm. documentaries are a lot easier to see now than they ever were.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Before it was just HBO.
That's your point.
My
or PBS or something.
You know, yeah. for doing this or to want to do it was watching The Art of Organized Noise.
Oh, yeah. That was
which was, you know, a great piece was done by QT3. Mm-hmm. And it was like, wow, I'm looking at this, not always the best shots, mm-hmm. you know, not some huge budget, mm-hmm. you know, all right, but they captured the heart of what was happening. And I sort of tried to go into what we're doing, you know, in this sort of way. It's sort of weird. We're almost done. It's really crazy.
Well, see, but that's the thing I like about
you
documentaries.
You put in work, bro.
Yeah, but documentaries I love is that the there's an accepted sense of I don't need to have these really great cinematic shots. Mm-hmm. I just need to be able to, you know, and I can mix format. I can mix the medium. I can put in the still frames and, like, do the animation camera stuff. There's mm-hmm. a lot you can do, which is interesting to help you tell your story and hit those emotional beats that you need to hit when you're not, and it's not scripted. You know, right. you can't control the moment of someone's mm-hmm. behavior. So you kind of manufacture it in an interesting way. I don't know. I mean, I have been so fascinated by what people do, and I'm very fascinated about, you know, the thing you guys are doing. I mean, so.
Yeah, I mean, well,
so
like
when's it done? When's the editing happening? Is editing happening now? Like
we have a little
music?
Bit more.
We have one, possibly two more shoots in right. New York. We have a great second unit guy out there that's going to shoot those, and then we're going to post. Got a great editor, you know.
Yes.
So everything's kind of in position. Like pretty much, we're waiting for what will probably end up being like what, like you know. 30 minutes of tape.
Right.
And that'll come in and then, you know, we'll pick what we want to use and send it off to the right. editor.
But very grateful for all the support, including from you all too. This
sure.
is a
yeah.
sort of a premature treat for everybody, mm-hmm. but we've been fortunate to have great support from our friends and colleagues, and there seems to be a lot of real interest just when we talk about it. So I don't take it for granted. I'm very grateful.
So Does this plan to be feature, is it plan to be the feature length, or is it plan to be a short thing? I mean,
oh, I'm just curious. Like, yeah, we've sort of been going back and forth about that. Probably we're aiming for 60 minutes for TV.
Okay.
Ideally, you know, you would, you know, all kinds of places. Yeah, but
you got the contact. We have
enough for feature length.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I say cut them both.
You know, my preference is to do exactly that.
That was what we always said.
Yeah.
We said we're going to do two cuts, do a theatrical, we'll do one for television, and, you know, see how it goes. Yeah. So that's, you know, editing process, you know, is the last sort of step. Mm-hmm. By summer, you know, we should be ready to roll, and, you know, it should be, you know.
Yeah, I'd be cataloging tunes today, but here kicking it with y'all. So it's all good.
It's so much stuff, man. I mean, that's the other thing that's cool. At least both of us are kind of looking at, you know, footage, and we're generally on the same page.
Yes.
You know, but it's having two hands in, you know, a really tiny shoebox project like this.
Yes.
That's the other thing I think with docs, too. Once camera equipment has become less expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we shot this on a 5D Mark III, but at 1080, you know, so really great quality, really rich colors, you know, our sound is cool. And it's sort of like, well, hey, we know that we'll get a chance to do some bigger, better stuff, but this is a tribute to, you know, a really great dude, you know.
Imagine if it was 16 millimeter. What would be happening now? You guys would be like, well, we got 20 minutes of footage. Exactly. We're getting another 20 next year.
That's very real.
I'm working on this one movie. I'm planning to steal a little bit of that, you know.
Can I bring it back to the end of Oscar season?
Yeah, of course.
Because this will be post-Oscars. We'll all be in a La La Land haze, I strongly suspect.
Most likely.
So the cinematographer for Moonlight, his name is escaping me, he won the Spirit Award.
Yes, yes.
And it made me think of you all, and we all love Moonlight, I suspect. But he was the guy spinning the camera around for a lot of those circular shots, which I generally have mixed feelings about. Mm. I think sometimes directors do more than it was required in terms of their visual expression. Mm-hmm. Could be my writer bias, but sometimes, so I'm not a big fan of that if it's not really tied to the storytelling. Mm-hmm. I think Moonlight was executed so well done, like you all talked about last week, that it takes nothing away from it. But it was nice to see the cinematographer get some shine, because he obviously had a lot to do with bringing that piece to life.
Yeah, I mean,
and I care. It made me care more.
I think cinematographer has a lot to do with a lot of movies
about cinematography. Yeah.
That's
my point. Now, working on a film myself is giving me more of an appreciation.
Understood.
So I'll start.
Well,
to
this
look
is
for
something
that.
You know, because I just spent the last 4 days at the Hollywood Black Film Festival with our short, checking out stuff, and it's like I was talking with these guys yesterday,
and shout out to the whole team.
Yes, the whole team that was there to help us get our film, Architects of Crime.
Architects of Crime.
What was interesting, you know, a couple people had seen our movie, that these other directors that we saw, like, we saw them 4 or 5 times, so we became kind of, you know, like good comrades with them. But they were remarking a lot about how our film was shot and how poorly these other films were shot.
Oh, I'm sure our film totally stood out.
Because he was asking us, because he was saying, why wasn't your film in the trailer for the whole thing?
We have no say.
I said, we don't have any say. And he's like, yeah, but see, this is the thing that I was telling him about cinematography. So cinematography is a really tricky subject to get good. And the reason why it's so important, and even for what you guys are doing, is when it's bad, it takes you out.
That's right.
Yeah.
It takes you out. Sure. And when it's really good, it's seamless, and you kind of focus more into what's happening with the story. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you'll see things that are like, oh shit, that was a cool shot. But that's just a shot, as opposed to the whole moment that they created to get to that. I mean, I feel what you mean about the scenes in Moonlight when they circle around. I mean, and I thought in the beginning of Moonlight, when the little boy is being chased into that first scene into that crack house, like, I thought that was just a little too shaky. I was like, but that's my bias about, I don't like shaky cam that much, because it's kind of like, what's interesting? I mean, like, not interesting, what's important to me in the frame? Mm-hmm. You know, let me see that by, like, keeping it so
radical.
But, you know, the cool thing about that is then he got to that point where now he's just going to like slow it down. Just like keep it still.
Oh, he had a lot of that.
Great about.
And then he would just go. you know what I mean?
And at some point, stood out to me the other day, he was like, you know, that movie's cool because there's a lot of scenes in that where it comes in and it's soft focus and it snaps into focus. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, that's just kind of how memories are. You're like thinking, you're like, oh yeah, now this comes together, which I think is interesting. I mean, I'm glad that movie won. I didn't watch the Spirit Awards yesterday or hear about it. I don't know what I was doing. Oh,
you guys went back to the festival?
Yeah, we went last night. We went to see last night and we were there in the middle of the day to see Abdul Malik Abbott had a film in there. He wanted me to come see
it. Another one in there?
It was called The Curse of War, I believe. It was about this PTSD thing. I thought it was pretty good.
Is it a movie?
Short, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but it's interesting you brought that up about Moonlight, because that to me, I think, is the one thing about all the films, save for Arrival, that are up this year for all of the awards. It's not even just those cinematography awards. That had a really fascinating color palette.
I'll tell you, when I first became aware of it, having the good fortune to work with Ernest Dickerson back in the Lincoln Heights days, he was a director by then, of course, but he had all kinds of stories about shooting for Spike.
Right.
And also shooting for, I believe Juice was his first
I worked with director on gig. On one of his first TV things.
And listening to Spike in interviews reference the cinematography that Ernest handled for him and how they were boys back in NYU and the whole thing. So that was sort of my first professional awareness of it. But he had nothing but stories, and they weren't in a technical sense. He wasn't talking about setting up shots and the camera angles. It was all about, what do we need to do to tell the story? What do we need to do to execute this scene on the highest level? So I just had an appreciation.
Well, see, I think that's what a lot of people don't. Ernest and Spike had a really great relationship for those first five Spike Lee joints that I don't know are the same. Those films aren't the same, I think, with someone else who's working. You know, if you look at the early Reginald Hudlin films, it's a little different. They don't have the same kind of like. There's a lot of bold choices they both embrace to do, particularly with color.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the guy who Spike worked with after that a lot was Malik Saeed, and he's got an interesting look. But I don't think and I like his work on Belly the most. I think he's only did a couple of movies. I mean, he got Game is pretty good. But I think that Spike kicked it up another level when he started working with Matt Labatique, who shoots a lot of stuff with Darren Aronofsky. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Darren Aronofsky's films and you look at Spike's films, they're like so different in a lot of ways. And you kind of see, but there's still things that Matt brings to it. And I think that's what's interesting to hear what, you know, like these filmmakers, when they're sitting there, the directors, they're talking with the DP and they know they got to translate everything emotionally through what that person brings. Like, how do we do this with the color? And they got to bring in, you know, the production designer. So what's the light going to come in? Mm-hmm. So it all kind of like speaks as one thing, you know, and that's when and that's what I think that Moonlight did a really good job. Same with Bradford Young, who's doing Arrival. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious now that he's doing the Han Solo film. Like, what the hell is that going to look like? Because it should be dope.
Well, I really dig Brad's style. I was going to give him a shout out, and if you didn't, you know, Howard Grad worked on Selma, you know, and like I said, he's having his first moment, you know, right now.
Yeah.
But I think that it really is about the collaborative relationship you have with your director. You know, I would imagine that back in those early days, you know, I mean, Spike was the king. I mean, he was that crew of guys, you know, who had come up in film school together, who were around each other for hour upon hour upon hour, conversation upon conversation, watching movie after movie, no different than Trace and I have or what have you. You know, Ernest knows what Spike wants. You know, knew Spike and knew how to put his own touch on anything that he did. I think that's why he became a director so quickly, you know, because he had a sense of his own.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the one thing that a lot of people don't, you know, the process I have when I look at filmmakers is I look at their work, and I'm always looking at who's their DP.
Right.
And you see these guys, they work in these little spurts where they'll do 5-6 films with the same DP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something, and who knows what happens. And then, it, you know, the early Oliver Stone stuff is not the same without Robert Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some sort of falling out, I think, around U-Turn, and they didn't work together anymore.
Oh, that was that movie was a disaster for everybody involved, yeah, from what I heard.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then next thing you know, Robert Richardson is working for he picks up and does all the work for Tarantino,
mm-hmm.
and then he also does the work when he can get him on Martin Scorsese. And Scorsese's like his last 4 or 5 films. You know, Wolf of Wall Street and Aviator. I think they first worked together on Aviator. There's a different kind of muscle that you see that Scorsese is able to exercise because he's working with a different type of cinematographer. Mm-hmm. I mean, his early guy Michael Chapman, who was worked on with Scorsese, he's different looks, you know, and you look at The Godfather is not the same without Gordon Willis. Like, all those movies aren't the same, you know? And then the other film, Apocalypse Now.
By the way, listeners, you see we got a damn cinephile on here.
Chris's cinephile is so the
funny thing is,
thorough.
I was about to mention Gordon Willis, so I'm glad you brought him up.
It's interesting when you see these people, like, they work with somebody else, and then they get a different, and their work changes in a way that's when you know the cinematographer is really bringing a lot to the collaboration, mm-hmm. because the director's work changes in a way that is so different. It's they work in these different type of projects, mm-hmm. that are not the same kind of thing. So I think that's what you got to explore. You know,
so, I have to say though, I'm very excited about the Han Solo thing though,
I just don't think we need it.
I don't think we need it. No, that now see that's a that's different all. Conversation.
I'll say this, maybe not for me or my generation, mm-hmm. but I think Han's a great character that wasn't really given his due in the reboot for what it was worth.
Han was good because it was Harrison Ford.
No, fair enough.
If he ain't gonna have Harrison Ford, what the fuck are we watching him for?
No, and
that's the point. Well, I guess you didn't like Rogue One.
Okay. And, well,
and the kid they got, like I first saw him in that Hail Caesar movie. He wasn't the kid. There's Harrison Ford. If you look at his work pre Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't have this kind of, like, his persona is not shining through. He's just trying to be a working actor.
Yeah,
and literally like Han Solo.
We saw he had a sense of humor.
Is him.
You yes. have to give him is his him. Due for creating that character and bringing him to life.
Because if you look at all his work post-Solo, except for Jones, because Jones is kind of like a...
Is Jones post?
Yeah, it's a modern-day
post.
Solo.
Yeah, post. Yeah.
He never gets to add that bit of humor and that roguishness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of all the movies that he's done.
But there's also no in between.
Here he does, I think. But
yeah, I mean, I think he got better, and he probably got better projects over time. With Star Wars, there's no in between. You're either rocking with it or you're not.
Yes.
And there's some first generation types who don't really. So I think if you can. Because The Force Awakens and Rogue One, we didn't really need those either, in a way. But
I think we needed a Han Solo type character in Rogue One.
They were well done enough. Even Clone Wars, even a cartoon, I think those are good enough to let you know that there is a space for these characters we didn't see in their formative years.
Mm-hmm.
So the young Han, the young Lando Calrissian, at minimum, I will credit them for creating the space in which you can tell those.
I think that's a good statement. I always feel like you've got way more Star Wars stuff in the universe to explore that is completely untouched. That would be more exciting to me.
The books were hot.
Yeah. Now here's something that's interesting to me about, and I'm very curious to see if they do this with the Han Solo film. Very, very curious. Is that I've been listening to the Force Awakens soundtrack quite a bit. I've been writing some stuff right now, and I realized. One of the reasons why I like that movie so much is only because of the score.
Not really.
Because John Williams knows how to whip people's asses.
John Williams.
And they didn't use John Williams for the score in Rogue One.
Huh.
And I'm curious, is he going to do the score for Han Solo? Because if he doesn't, I guarantee you the movie's not as good as it could be.
Right now.
Interesting.
I'll say that right now.
Put down the gauntlet.
Man.
It's hard to argue with John Williams.
I'm telling you right now because like I've been kind of on this kick, you know, because maybe like a month ago, 2 months ago, there was a Spotify thing about someone had a list about cinematic scores. Just playing. I just put it on 400 songs, whatever. All of a sudden, this score comes on, and I know it, but I don't know what movie it is from. And I'm just like, this tingle rolls through my body, and I'm like, who wrote this music? Who was it? Whatever is this? And it's the opening to Jurassic Park, which I haven't seen since I saw the movie when it originally came out.
The original
one. Yeah. Okay. So it's been like 25 years since I've seen the movie or know the score, really. And I'm like, this motherfucker is so damn good. Mm-hmm. It's insane. And then I've been listening to a lot. I've listened to the Saving Private Ryan thing a lot, which is very kind of like, it's very narrow, but it's something I'm working on. I just realized that he's one of these few guys who knows how to like do something with the music. And honestly, like movies don't work without music.
Mm-mm.
Like not like television. Like television can go without music. Mm-hmm. I mean, music is incidental in television.
And there's only like, I would think in terms of scores, maybe 10 guys who are signature. You know, like what?
Hans Williams,
yeah. Hans Zimmer, Danny Elfman, the Newmans, Randy Newman, yeah. Thomas Newman. And those are the folks I think of offhand.
Bernard Herrmann, who did all the damn Hitchcock shit.
There's some women that are really
Yeah, I
was curious because I was trying to think of female scorers, but it is a really important and sometimes overlooked, you know, part of the arc of what the final product of a film is. So I can rock with you on that. I kind of argue in that I think that there is room for a lot of story in that universe because it's so big.
I know.
And the movie, I'm curious to see how Han met Chewbacca or, you know, how...
Right. You know what? Someone posted this on Facebook the other day and I was lost. There's some sort of like life debt that Chewie owes... Han Solo.
Is that in the book or something?
I don't know if that's in the book.
I do know this, and you know, this is getting really fanboy, but the Wookiees were enslaved by the Empire and kind of farmed out as, you know, just cheap, you know, free
pack
labor.
Animals. They're like pack animals.
Yeah, they're basically the slaves of the Star Wars universe.
Okay.
So, you know, maybe apparently some kind of way Han, you know, got Chewie out. Yeah. I mean, because he can't pilot, you know, they are an intelligent species. And you know, also I'm want to see young Lando Calrissian. I mean, for me, you know, as a boy, he's the first black sci-fi character I knew about. Mm-hmm. So
personally, I'd rather see a straight Lando movie.
Yeah,
and have Han come in as like a little tertiary character, come in just briefly, touches his life, and then goes out of it. Mm-hmm. That's what I would want to see.
If the first one hits, maybe. You know, I think right now just. When you're in the business longer enough, you just think about what's profitable, the chances folks will take. I think in this kind of Disney setup, the all African American, the all colored folks, Star Wars movie is a given.
That's not gonna happen.
It'll happen, it'll be straight to video. It'll happen.
I
think it'll happen.
Here's the thing: you don't need to make it. It doesn't need to be Black Panther because I feel like the thing that's so fascinating about Lando is. And people, they never. This doesn't get remarked upon. It's not that he had the Millennium Falcon. I win that in the game. People bet. How is he running Bespin? How is a black man? But since there's no racism really in Star Wars, but how is he running Bespin? That's a fascinating story because he's a rogue. He's a criminal. He's a con man.
Right.
That's a story.
Hmm.
And there are a lot of things they have to fill in about that story in particular in the next installment. Just in that,
I'm curious.
Like I said, we're going to talk Star Wars. The big thing is that how did the what's her name? I can't believe I'm blanking on it. Just won an Oscar. The sister Kenyon. You know, you guys all know
Lupita.
Lupita Nyong'o.
Okay.
How that character found a lightsaber, which you know. Should have been somewhere deep down.
Well, I think we're gonna find that.
No. I mean, of course, we have to. That's a big story. See, and if we're a group of writers sitting here, I mean, it's those story pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, as kids or wherever you are, you get into a thing, a mystery is laid out for you. You know, and you never let go of it. I mean, look, David Lynch is bringing back Twin Peaks after 20 something years. And there are enough people who believe in that, believe in the impact that it has, that from what I, you know, the rumor is, you know, he's shot some 17 hour movie and is just chopping it up in post, you know, for one or two seasons. But
there's
generational value for revisiting, you know, cultural icons, you know, pieces of material that define generations. And I guess because I'm a man of a certain age at this point, I sort of welcome that. I like the idea of maybe going back and checking out something from my youth as long as it's good.
Right.
No. If it's not good, well then, you know, I mean, hey, I remember a lot of people were disappointed, you know, with The Phantom Menace, you know, when it came out. Like, that was like, everybody's like, oh, you know, they just jerked us off for, you know, 3 hours. but I, you know, if you want to talk about music, John Williams' Duel of the Fates comes out of that. I think that's personally one of my favorite pieces of his. So,
but again, because he knows what the hell he's doing.
John Williams. I would, since Kenji is here, and this is, we're going left, because I could roll with y'all on Star
Steer
Wars.
Steer this motherfucker, steer it.
But, and you know, you've set us up. You steer for all of us, which is appreciated. I would like Kenji to talk about his experience in the room, just as coming in as a staff writer and learning, because I know who listens to this podcast and they would.
I was going to ask you about that too. I was curious to know about like how you got that job if you weren't in town or if you were in town at the time.
We know we can't talk about the show, but can you talk about your way
sure,
there?
Sure. I've been friends for a long time with a writer producer named Adam Glass. Has some credits in
I know
film
Adam
TV.
Yeah.
Glass and I have been really good friends since about 2000 when I adapted my first book for Searchlight with State Street Pictures a long time ago, and you know, sort of we worked together on a couple of different things, tried to pitch some stuff, you know, didn't catch, what have you. I came out, more or less, it was kind of trial and error, but he's always sort of believed in my voice. And so when he started to work with Lena, he called me and sort of said, I'm working with, you know, Lena Waithe, this, you know, young writer, kind of reminds me of you, you know, you were, you know, 25 and really political and angry and that kind of thing. And I was like, really? You know, it's like, you hear that, it's like, wow, like, really? Okay, I'm curious. And I was working on Augie. You know, I'd been working on Augie for a couple of months. And he just calls me up around, you know, and sort of says, well, hey, look, there's an opening. You know, there's a staff writer job. I need you to send me a sample in an hour. Now, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't primarily writing TV. I was writing features. But I took a script that I had written recently and reformatted it like in like 2 hours. Like, all right, I got to turn 92 minutes into a 60 minute pilot, and the clock is ticking. So I took something that I believed in and did that. And, you know, I was fortunate in that two things happened. A friend of his, who's also our showrunner, Elwood Reed, who's done a Bridge, Cold Case. He's got a 13, 14 year career.
Brilliant author.
Brilliant author as well. Decorated guy who I had met at a fight party. strangely enough, the guy's house who we all met at just passed away yesterday. And the three of us were talking about it on Friday at the job, and it was like, wow. And all of a sudden, it's got Scott Liu, R.I.P. Scott Liu. He was suffering with ALS for a long time, but he's really, really good guy. Point being is that, you know, I put in my sample, and, you know, I'll tell you the story because it's kind of amazing. I had no TV credits. And, you know, so sort of some of the folks at the network were sort of like, well, why do you want this guy? You know, like he's a novelist. Why are you fighting so hard for this? Because El was like, look, you know, I want another novelist to come in and to be able to work on this thing because he feels like novelists have a better sense of story. And so, you know, more or less the executive who was involved in making those decisions read my book and said, hey, I don't have any problems. Like, you know, let him get in the room. So I came into the room as, you know, sort of.
How much time went by from the time you submitted? Can you say that?
3 months.
Maybe. Yeah, so I'm always trying to take time.
And it's a long 3 months because staff writers, and for those of you who don't know.
And they're the last ones.
Yeah, they're the last guys of staff. So they had to get the director. They had to get everyone else. Mm-hmm. And then last, I had to get my deal last, you know. So.
And they're also worrying about how much money they have for you. They might say, we need to really lowball you.
Don't forget, I know the story, but don't forget the stops and starts between Kenji and Adam like years prior to this.
Let me ask you, because I met Adam Glass probably 12 years ago because he used to hang out a lot with
Anthony?
Anthony, yeah.
He used to write, they used to write together.
Yeah. That's because this other guy I know knows Anthony. They had a falling out, but that's how I met Anthony and Adam. And I always thought Adam was a very savvy guy.
Oh, extremely. Has a really.
You meet so many people in this game, and you fall, and you don't see what happens to them. Next thing you know, mm-hmm. you see them doing something. So I'm excited to see that he's doing that.
Oh, he's doing a lot, man. He kind of went from working with Anthony into the comic book world. He wrote the Suicide Squad episodes that feature Harley Quinn in the current, in the film incarnation. Did a lot of Deadpool stuff. I mean, really got involved in the comic book world and ended up working on Supernatural for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And as big of a show as that is, opens a lot of doors in that world.
Yeah.
And, when he was working on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, this show came up. And, more or less he decided to work on the Shy as well. But it's been, as a staff writer coming in, to get back to your point, as a novelist, I sort of went in thinking, well, what all the writers in the room do is come up with the entire, story from beginning to end. Like, we're all sitting at home. Our homework is to come up with the whole episode. And there's like 10 of them, and that's how it works. And so, when I get in, it really is like this kind of collective development, all these different minds. Literally, idea by idea.
Breaking
story. Idea by idea, episode by episode. And the way that something goes from where the show's creator starts with it mm-hmm. and where it ends up once the showrunner and everyone else is involved, it's really fast-paced, and it's like being on the greatest drug ever. It's the greatest high I've ever had in my life mm-hmm. because, you're getting paid to, in some ways, rearrange furniture inside of, someone else's structure. Mm-hmm. But in another way, we all are in there. It's a confessional, dropping our own personal stories and, weaving that into a voice that supports, mm-hmm. Kind of lines up with where Lena is. True. And so it's
shout out to Lena on this. I haven't read the script, but I heard the script is amazing. So
and we got some really great actors, man, and really really great storyline. I mean, it's super hush hush. So I can
understand.
I'll say this: I think that fans and viewers are in for something really different and really mm-hmm. interesting mm-hmm. when it comes out.
Is it Clark Johnson doing the?
He did the pilot? He did one of the pilots, but he's not working on the series, I don't think. I'm not sure who's the director, but I know that Rick Famuyiwa is directing the actual pilot. So Dope, The Wood, Brush, yeah. So he's working on it.
He's supposed to do Flash, and then he backed out for some reason.
Really?
Who can say? Yeah. There was a disagreement somewhere.
I know. Look, I look at it this way because it's the thing that we're going through with mm-hmm. Jazz and our thing. It's mm-hmm. like, like you don't know. It's interesting working with someone like that way because my brother and I are doing a project. We're directing something. And it's like the first time where these other writers were like, we want you to come do our thing. And we don't want you to
change anything.
Don't change anything.
Right.
We're good. Just come in and be the director. And it's an interesting process because particularly guys who write, mm-hmm. it's like, I see problems.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make this adjustment?
Right.
And a lot of it is not necessarily even like writing problems, but it's like, I got to direct this, and I got to make these actors do something. So mm-hmm. I need something on the page that lets me tell them what to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that's just like, I think only just comes from doing that, from going from the concept to set and making acting right. and seeing, oh, shit, that worked when we said it mm-hmm. at home
mm-hmm.
and in the fucking rehearsal. But it doesn't work when the lights are in front of someone yeah. and I'm looking at it through the camera. But that's interesting to know that, the process that you work for. I mean, I think there's too much mystery about what goes on right. in the writer's room. People are like, what the hell happens there?
But see, that's the thing. There's no one formula. Every room is different. Every story is different. The permutations of, executives, development that's involved, it's all different, and it's this big pot of gumbo that I think, coming into it, this being my first time out.
How many meetings did you go on in order to, because you clearly had to meet with Lena and the showrunner and all that. Did you go through all that?
I dealt with the showrunners.
Okay.
More or less, I think the way it went, and it's just among the top folks in command,
mm-hmm.
everyone sort of had one or two folks that they wanted in there. And so I ended up, you know, sort of Adam brought me in, mm-hmm. and, you know, Elwood made sure that, you know, I stayed in. And so I luckily had two guys, you know, that believed in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But just to say this, and it's very fresh, I haven't even gotten to a production part. You know, I've never, mm-hmm. you know, set and the change that you have and those kind of things. Really, right now,
you guys still in the room. We started.
We're still in the room.
So I'm just curious about this show. I mean, it's Showtime, right?
Right.
So you guys are gonna have the whole season written before you even go to start shooting, right? Or maybe six episodes in or something like that, five or six.
Something like that.
Okay. You
know, something like that.
It's at least four. Yeah. Positive about that,
yeah,
for sure.
Well, the moral of the story.
I mean, to me, it's kind of the fascinating model about the cable series, mm-hmm. is that you know you get to write so much of the story as you want to tell for that season before you even go shoot it. I think it's fascinating because you can really hone in on some things. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain shows I know, like The Nick. Mm-hmm. You know, The Nick, man, they, you know, like Soderbergh did every episode, directed it. So he was like, I'm not going to wait for you guys to write shit. I love the pilot. Mm-hmm. Write the other nine.
Right.
And then I'll do this like a 10-hour movie and we'll just go. And I was, you know.
And he's sitting on the camera too, ain't that a bit?
Yeah, and he's editing everything. Like his whole process is, I mean, if there's anyone who's a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and wants to be, I want to do all the shit and blah, blah, blah. You guess what? You can. Because mm-hmm. Steven Soderbergh.
If you're that good.
Steven Soderbergh, he's the DP and the editor.
But if you're Steven Soderbergh, yeah. you know what I mean?
No, but the thing is that it took him like 15 years before he started doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't until he did Traffic that was the first time he DP'd something.
Mm-hmm. But he had a problem too. I remember on the director's commentary, he had a problem because in terms of credit or the Cinematographers Guild was pissed.
It's not his name. It's his dad's name. Peter Andrews, mm-hmm. is the cinematographer. That's his dad's name.
You can't have your name as both director and DP on one film. Yeah.
Well, there's some people who can because John Badham does that. But I think he's one of the only guys. But you're right. And
Robert Rodriguez did it here and there.
Yeah, but Robert Rodriguez is not in the director's guild. I think that's why he.
Yeah, there's he jumped Tarantino out. And a lot of those dudes. They don't play.
And then, but then the woman Anne Bernard on mm-hmm. Soderbergh's films. That's his mom's name, and that's him editing that shit. He wanted to work with this guy Stephen Mirioni, who cut like the Ocean's films, and he couldn't get him for the third one. He was like, "Fuck, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it." You know. But the thing is that I bring that up because what's fascinating about certain kind of things like that, I mean, they did this on The Nick, and they probably don't do this on a lot of shit, is if you've seen the show, you know, it's all these medical procedures and shit like that. I mean, they mm-hmm. shot all that shit like in a week for every episode.
Hardcore. They went hard.
Yeah. You know, they did it like a movie, and I was like, you know what? That's the most gruesome shit in that show, all the hospital shit. Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting podcast about the writers were talking about, and they mm-hmm. brought in the prosthetics guy about how that was a gore fest for all of them. So I'm curious to see what your experience is once you go into production and see, because you know.
Do the staff writers, you guys get to produce your episodes? So, you know,
there's a possibility that some of us may. Okay. And you know, like that's like I said, I'm the bottom guy. So you know, any information that you want.
Well, I don't think you usually say I want to. It's just the showrunner usually has you know, whatever the rule is. Or like on our show, the staff writer produces or whatever the fuck.
I'll say that Elwood is really working hard to make sure that we all writers in the room get the best out of the experience, you know, and develop as much as we can individually.
It benefits you the best, you know.
And, you know, as we move on to other things, because it's a very unique room. I mean, mm-hmm. it's almost outside of the showrunners, it's all African-American, mm-hmm. You know, three women, three men, you know, mm-hmm. so we have from a variety of different places, from the continent, from Africa, east, west, south, a little bit of everybody, and maybe ranging from, you know, 28 mm-hmm. to, you know, 45, 50. So you have a lot of different experience in there. So going into the show, there are a lot of different characters of a lot of ages, so it works. Like, we're really, really trying to create a world.
Keep doing your work, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the moral of the story. Denzel's Image Award speech this year, if you haven't seen it, it's online all over. I'm sure you should. He talks about it. Keep working. Don't give up. Mm-hmm. It is work. if it were easy, a lot more people would be doing it. That's my message to
everybody. I agree with you.
And I'm talking to myself as well.
Well, I think, you know,
because my dude got up in there, so obviously I'm inspired by that.
Well, I want to read one of your novels, but you mentioned your name before, and I was like, why do I know that name? I can't remember it. But when you said you worked at State Street, I think that's why I've heard your name, because
unless you saw me on BET back in the day on Teen Summit, like,
no, no, because what's the woman's name used to run Poppy Hanks.
Yeah.
See, she might have mentioned your name to us way back in like 2000 or something.
No,
like
that's
so
crazy. Yeah, that's
I don't know, because you mentioned Kenji, but I didn't know your last name. And then when I saw the clip, I was like, anybody.
Small world.
Now, but back to your point about the work. I mean, yeah, I think a lot of people don't know how hard it is. Don't realize how hard it is. I mean, it's one of the things that we were talking about a little bit last week when we did the Oscars thing about the scripts. I mean, I didn't get really into like technique on the page.
Yeah,
and it's one of the things that I actually enjoy the most about writing.
Did you finally watch Lion, or you still just did you read? Because he read the script and was like, "Dude, it's a page turner. Like, I can't even turn it."
I did listen to last week.
And then the wackest thing, is, I've started reading these Hollywood Reporter like blind Oscar ballot motherfuckers and shit talking about that Lion, like the second half is like a different movie. It slogs, and I was like, damn. So I haven't had the gumption to get up and read it. But I'm doing my old fucking cinema rewatch series the last 2 weeks, so I haven't had a time to watch anything.
What are you rewatching?
I'm rewatching.
Right before the Oscars.
Well, I watched The Master. The
Joaquin Phoenix?
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix thing. Mm-hmm. I watched The Battle of Algiers.
Oh, okay. All right.
I watched this movie called Le Samurai, this Jean-Pierre Melville film from the late 60s, French film. And then Social Network. I'm watching some more, but sometimes, you know, something clicks in my head, and I'm just like, I need to see this.
Yeah,
I need to see this. And it's all movies I've seen before. And then we watched The Third Man.
One of my dad's favorites.
Which was kind of research, too, for
me. Let me ask you guys a question, slightly off. Just because we're talking about, you're talking about research and just like watching things or whatever. So you guys know I just wrote the Black Wall Street movie. So, and the next movie they hired me to write is a soldier PTSD movie, right? So it was a really interesting thing where I would be in here when I was writing the movie. I'd be sitting in here working my butt off, 10 o'clock at night, whatever the fuck. I'd come home and I'd be just mentally drained from studying lynchings and, you know, all that shit. And I'd come home and I'd be just gone. So I'd turn on fucking Project Runway or whatever the fuck, whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm studying all this soldier PTSD stuff and it's twice as worse.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Because here's what I realized. Just interesting thing, I just want to ask you guys opinions on.
Sure.
Here's what I realized is when I was studying about lynchings and the Klan and all that shit, it was different for me because I'm a little, it's 100 years ago. There's nobody I'm interviewing. You know, who's alive.
Right.
And even the few documentaries they had on people, you know, most of them are gone, you know. And so I'm disassociated from it. And it's just images to me.
Right.
You know, I mean, you feel something, of course, and whenever you watch anything, you know, death or whatever.
Real quick, it's also hard to fathom lynching now.
Yes. Maybe that's part of it.
If you don't have a perspective on what things were like, I remember just being fortunate to have had this experience. My grandmother once a year went down. She's from rural Virginia, outside of Richmond, maybe like 2 hours. Same part of the world, D'Angelo, the singers from Pharrell, all those folks. And, you know, she and two of her cousins, older cousins, very infirm. You know, I think at that point they were even on their way out. And I was a boy at the time. Maybe I was 6 or 7 or 8. You know, they were talking about how, you know, people would disappear, you know, or talking about how, you know, black man says something, you know, to a white man and is gunned down, you know, in the middle of the town for everyone to see it. And hearing those things, being so young, I had that personal connection to it. And am able to understand even in some ways how it connects to now. I mean, if you look at politically what's happened in the last 6 months, you know, and kind of this sort of Empire Strikes Back moment we're living in, you know, currently, or just description of a fool or whichever way you want to see it, folks aren't as bold You know, mm-hmm. what I mean, we got remote controls and, you know, flat screens now, mm-hmm. but the mentality is still there. You know, I just think that it's camouflage and there's a lot of subterfuge and a lot of static that gets in the way of you really seeing it. Mm-hmm. But the alt-right made it really clear. They are disenfranchised, angry, mostly white men, you know, who felt like they had their nuts cut off by the fact that there was a biracial president in office for 8 years that didn't fuck up and, you know, didn't get caught up in any scandals. Mm-hmm. And what they can't stand for following that is a woman, you know, being their next president. So much so that they will do anything and everything to make examples. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, and that's kind of where you are.
Yeah, but I was just tripping on how I just wrote this movie about, you know, lynchings and all other shit, which I thought was going to just destroy, you know, who I am. And now I'm writing something about PTSD and soldier stuff. Here's what I realized. They're interviewing somebody, right? Like, I'm watching all these documentaries, right, just to get my research in. They'll be interviewing a soldier, and he'll be talking about, like, oh, you know, I was in Iraq or, you know, Afghanistan, whatever it is, and came back, and I have nightmares or whatever the fuck. And then they'll show you shots of somebody in the pit, you know what I mean, right, next to somebody, like what he just said, as if it was that person. So somehow it's like much more harder for me. Oh,
the type of reenactment.
Yeah, yeah, it's much harder for me to take.
Well, you are connected to the emotional core of all of your characters. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't have all of the story details worked out yet, you always keep that connection. Mm-hmm. So everything that you're seeing is going to resonate in a way that's different, and you're giving yourself the ability to choose the best from that. And so you'll have the soldier's experience, the source of the PTSD and the symptoms and what they're going through, but you're also going to have the emotional connection to the person. You take those two and then you combine that to get the results of the soldier's life now that he has this thing that he's dealing with. So you're just connected and, you know, it's going to continue to be taxing.
It's affecting me. Like, it's okay, a weird thing.
It's going to come through in the work.
See, this is so I want to ask you, because you made your point about the interviews of then of the lynchings, and even when you hear about people tell stories about Jim Crow compared to what you're doing. These modern documentaries, I mean, like the filmmaking techniques, I'm wondering how, I mean, that's obviously what's affecting you, is that they're trying to do these reenactments and they're trying to like...
Well, they're just showing you like still images of, but it's like was real faces that are just like destroyed and blew up.
Because to me, I'm wondering this too. It's like, we've been at war for what, 15 years now?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's a permeation in our life. It's happening constantly. And we all, I mean, I don't know any, that's not true. I know two soldiers, but they were in the first Gulf War, not in this last 14 year kind of bullshit. I'm just curious, are we more in tune to what's going on because of the way that that war is being covered and that kind of thing? Because what you're seeing these photographs of the head blown off. I mean,
I was watching photographs of lynchings and it wasn't affecting me the same way.
I think it's more current, and I think it doesn't have a color. You know, I think for the number of folks that join the military, I mean, God knows we all know someone who did it, you know, to pay for college, to take care of their kid, you know, whatever it is, the fact that you can go over there to serve your country and come back permanently fucked up, and that really there's only so much service your country is going to do for you once you come back in that way. That can be really depressing, man. Mm-hmm. You know, if you see it over and over again, what's to say that that couldn't have been you? You know, what's to say that under the right set of circumstances, whether, you know, you went to school or not, what have you, that you could end up this broken person? I think for folks my age, I mean, we had plenty of Vietnam vets who came back, you know, strung out, banged out, screwed up. But I think with this conflict, you know, like you were saying, because it's just going on for so long, turning out more and more of these people, and it's the new Vietnam. You know, it's the new Vietnam in that, you know, you have an insurgency that is trying to establish itself where it is. You got regular guys going over there just trying to take care of the girl, the kid, what have you, and they come back never the same. I think that's what would sit with me. Lynchings, you know, if you have any understanding of a history of race in this country, you know, that's, it becomes a given, mm-hmm. you know, but it's kind of like that army be all you can be, mm-hmm. you know, armed forces, you know, spiel that we all see as boys.
Oh, propaganda. Growing,
right. But what I mean is we all dive into it, and what they never tell you, it's never said, it's never talked about until very recently, mm-hmm. that, hey, look, we're going to give you a gun and send you over there to do what you're ordered to do.
True.
We're not guaranteeing you're going to come back in one piece, one way or the other. That's the risk you take.
Well, see, you know, interesting, too, is that World War II and Korean War vets suffered the same thing, but they didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. They really pressed it.
It wasn't diagnosed.
Yeah, I just learned 2 years ago that my dad has PTSD. Yeah. Like, he didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of these things where you say to yourself, it's because of your point. We don't know what the cost of war is, the mm-hmm. damage of war is, and how it affects people and when they get back. And it's kind of like, I just wonder if, like, what our society, you know, this whole buttoned up era that everyone talks about, the 50s that Trump wants to bring back and shit, like an mm-hmm. asshole. I'm just kind of like, is the 50s like really a partial of the response of that kind of buttoned upness because of all those veterans
post World War II?
Yeah,
for sure.
You know, but we don't make that correlation because we look at it as a different kind of like expansion,
yeah, I mean, no,
middle class.
I was watching, speaking of documentaries, I just watched that Back to the Future documentary on, you know, I don't know if you saw it on Netflix, and it's about all like the fanboys and stuff.
Yeah.
Who all?
Oh, I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But of course, they interviewed all the main people. Are like, if you go back, what time would you go back? And they're all excited. Oh, I would go back to this year, or whatever. And I'm going, they didn't interview no brothers who said they would go back to anything.
You know, it's because that's the whole thing. I you know, like white men can go back to any time. And be straight.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
always better for us to look forward.
Well, that's a hilarious. I mean, that series on NBC, Timeless. You know, yeah, you sort of make this sort of a running weekly joke about that. You know, that ain't no joke.
Nah.
I was like, man, that dude was an idiot.
You know, and mm-hmm. that's the reason why I didn't watch that show, because they in the pilot, it's like the military forces a black guy to go. I was like, no. They, guess what? unless you put me in at gunpoint, I'm not going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going back to 1936
mm-hmm.
in America,
mm-hmm.
black, to stop a dent. No.
I'm with you. But I think
your
main character will reveal himself as you continue to do that.
Yeah.
And is he that?
Well, it's the guy who wrote it. I mean, he's you know, I'm coming and doing a page one again on another script.
Okay.
So
well, does he strike you more as someone who took the best economic option to join the military, or do you have very strong patriotic feelings?
Yeah, he's much more patriotic, like, from the South, you know.
Okay. Well, that's going to factor in, you know, before and after.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The PTSD.
Cool.
It's real.
All right. Well, thank y'all. Good episode, y'all.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for the invite, as always.
Exactly. So where you at, Chris?
I'm at shadowboxercinema.net
mm-hmm.
and at unauthorizedCBD on Twitter and Instagram.
Cool. Tracy?
One thing, I know we're wrapping up. I got engaged this week.
Oh, shit, dude.
Stacey be home soon.
That's my girl right there. I love it, Stacey.
Nah, no doubt. At The Real Trey, TheRealTray. Goofy dudes, I'm telling you, I can help you. Get my life coach on. And all the listeners, I get tweeted every time I'm on. So it's all love. Shout out to y'all.
At Kenji Jasper on Twitter, Kenji Jasper on Instagram, Kenji Jasper on Facebook, otherplacemedia.net.
That's what's up. And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest. You guys can follow the show, Screenwriters RR, on Twitter. Any questions, screenwritersrantroom@gmail.com. Please follow us on Facebook. And also, please go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We need that for the metrics. Shit like that. we'll see. We'll have Lisa back next week. And we'll go in on some pre-Oscar shit and a whole bunch of stuff like that.
Post-Oscar shit.
You mean? Yeah, post-Oscar.
Get well soon, Lisa's mama.
Yes, of course. Mama Lisa. So everybody joining in with us for 2017. You guys know how we're doing on the Rant Room. On the show, we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what, everybody?
2017.
Peace, y'all.
I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Rant Room. Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the rent room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Rant Room.